how you can vote to protect your liberty next on Principles and Policies. Welcome to today's Principles and Policies for Saturday. I am your host, Barry Sheets, Executive Director of the organization, the Institute for Principled Policy. And along with me today is my Vice Chairman and very good friend, Chuck Michaelis.
Glad to be here, and we're discussing a very important issue today.
That's right, Chuck. As folks who've been listening to the program during the one-hour weekday program at 5:30 here on the station have been listening to, you know that this week we've been discussing the three statewide ballot issues that you, as a registered voter, and I sincerely hope that everybody who's listening to me has registered and does plan to vote, you as a registered voter will be facing on your long-form ballot when you go to the polls on Tuesday, November the 8th. We talked about issue one, which was the issue regarding changing the mandatory retirement age for judges in the state of Ohio. We talked about issue two at some length, which is the law that would be changing the way Ohio's 28-year-old collective bargaining laws operate. And now today, to wrap up, we're going to be talking about state issue three. Now, Chuck, you know, this is one of those issues that, well, first of all, it's a great tutorial for people to understand how we can impact the laws and statutes of our state in multiple ways, because each of these three ballot issues, each one of them is a different means of how to get something to the ballot. I'm excited about that just for the simple idea of we're actually showing people, okay, our Ohio Constitution gives us three ways to get an issue onto the ballot. The first is by the legislature or elected officials simply passing a bill or resolution to take it to the ballot. And if they get enough support and both the House and the Senate and the governor signs it, then it gets mm-hmm. sent to the ballot. That's state issue one, the issue about the mandatory ages for judges. Another means, well, there's two other means on how things get on our statewide ballot. One is by the initiative, and we're going to be talking about that a little bit later, but that's issue three. And the other one is called referendum. And a referendum is when our elected officials, our legislature, passes a law that the people, for some reason, think, oh, goes too far, or doesn't go far enough, or is unnecessary. And they have the right to go out and collect signatures to bring that particular law to what's called a referendum, which is a vote of the people to determine up or down whether or not the law should be enacted or not. That's what we have with state issue two, because that was Senate Bill 5 that was passed by the legislature, and folks who opposed that measure went out and collected the signatures and brought this referendum on the ballot, which we call state issue two.
Well, this is one, too, that the state legislature has been working diligently to try to emasculate, if you will.
Because, you mean the initiative and referendum portions of the Constitution? Yes.
Making grassroots efforts almost impossible with some of the requirements for signature and the time frames and that kind of thing, partly because I think they got embarrassed over their lack of leadership in issues like, if one will remember the Community Protection Act, I think it was called, with
the Community Defense Act.
Defense Act that had to do with strip club.
Right, regulating adult businesses, yes.
And as I recall, that one of the things was the signatures were being collected. My memory has faded somewhat on this, but they didn't like the fact that they were being embarrassed because they refused to do the job, and therefore some grassroots groups were going to take it to the ballot.
Yeah, well, I'm kind of intimately familiar. Well, maybe I shouldn't use the term intimately when discussing strip clubs and adult businesses, but I was very much involved in that fight because I worked for the organization that brought the statute forward to the General Assembly in the form of a bill and tried to work it through the process. It was stymied by the Ohio Senate, who for some reason decided that they didn't really want to pass a measure to regulate businesses that are destroying communities and families. So our organization, Citizens for Community Values, when I worked back there for them, we went out and did that, you have the initiated statute. That's another piece that we could do as well, not just a constitutional amendment like issue three is, but the initiative also allows you to initiate statutory changes in our Ohio Revised Code, and that's what we did with that. We went out and collected the first round of signatures and brought it back to the legislature as a citizens' initiative and asked them to review it. Now, they had 4 months from that time frame to look at it and either pass it as it was, pass it amended, or reject it. And if they passed it, all well and good, and it's in. If they passed it amended, then the folks who collected the signatures, us, we had the option or opportunity to say, we don't like the changes you made, so we're going to collect another round of signatures and take the original language straight to the ballot, so the statewide ballot, so people can have a voice on this. Or if they reject it, we could take it, collect another round of signatures and take it straight to the ballot. Now, thankfully, we didn't have to execute right. that second round of signature gathering, because at the end of the day, when you've collected over 150,000 signatures of registered voters and you've sent them a copy of a piece of legislation and said, the voters want this passed, funny how elected officials who are locally elected by many of those people who signed that petition sit up and take notice and pass what you asked them to pass.
Well, it's amazing how the former Senate leadership basically allowed political brinksmanship to be played.
Yes.
Because that's exactly what it was. We will take this to the ballot if you don't fix it. And there were some overly cozy relationships, as I recall, between certain members of leadership of the Senate and certain people who were not in support of this bill.
There were some relationships of that nature, but we won't go into that for today's program.
But that's what can happen. That's why it's brinksmanship. Sometimes you have to be able to take politicians to the brink and show them,
that's right.
Look how deep this pit is.
Well, you see, and that's what brings us to today. That's what's why we're talking about State Issue 3. Because Issue 3 is a citizens' initiative. The citizens of the state, after in March 23rd of 2010, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was passed by the United States Congress and signed into law by President Barack Obama. We all commonly refer to that particular piece of legislation as Obamacare.
Yeah.
Which is federal mandates on what health care you can purchase, you can receive, and creates, I mean, huge bill, thousands of pages long, which creates a labyrinthian network of bureaucratic hoops to jump through in order just to take an aspirin, basically. Well, citizens in Ohio said, you know what? First of all, and again, most of these folks who started this petition effort with the Ohio Healthcare Freedom Amendment, which is what Issue 3 is, they were part of the Tea Party groups, the Liberty groups that had formed after mm-hmm. the 2008 election. Well, these folks got together and said, you know what? First and foremost, I'm having trouble figuring out where Congress has the right to pass anything related to healthcare at all. And secondly, isn't there this little thing back in the back? I mean, it's like a footnote, I guess. It's called the Bill of Rights to the Constitution. And right there, that 10th one right there, there's something about that says something about things being reserved to the people. We'll go into that a little bit more in depth as we go here in the program. But what they did was they got together and said, you know what? Not in Ohio. We don't think we want anybody, federal, state, or local bureaucrat, mandating what kind of care I should have, how much I have to have, and how much I have to pay for it, and whether or not I can go out on the market and buy different health care options. So they went around, and this was I got to give kudos to the leadership at the Ohio Healthcare Freedom folks who organized this, because they, for the last probably almost 2 years, at every fair, at every street parade, at every rally, concert, whatever it might be where citizens of Ohio might be gathering, whether it be the local Apple Festival or the sweet gum thing or the pumpkin show or whatever it might be, they went out with their clipboards and their ballots and their petitions, and they collected signatures. And they turned in hundreds of thousands of signatures. I think it was over 250,000 signatures that they turned in to actually allow the voters of the state of Ohio to have the say in whether or not we want to have the federal government mandate for us our health care choices. So they did. They went through the process. They collected their first round of signatures, took it, got their language certified by the Attorney General, which is our process in Ohio. And as a matter, just as a footnote, Ohio has probably one of the best ballot access standards in our Constitution, because we do allow for citizens' initiatives and referendums. Regardless of how you may feel about State Issue 2 or State Issue 3, the point is that that process, which allows the people to be able to become the higher authority over their elected legislators who may not be responding or listening to them, is a good thing to have. It's a good check and balance of what I call the fourth branch of government, which is the electors, not the elected.
And it's one of those things. There are a lot of states out there that don't have this method for affecting public policy. And the fact is that has turned out to be a nightmare in states like, if I'm not mistaken, Massachusetts, where it takes 2 years to get any changes made to their constitution. And for a good reason, and that is they want the public will to be take a somewhat cooler look at the issue. But the fact is that you've also got issues where there are people who are making a concerted effort to change the public will through propaganda effort, and basically they clap their hands together and say, "Great, we got 2 years to get more people into our camp."
Exactly. On either side of the issue, 2 years worth of radio ads and television ads and slick mailers and email campaigns
and browbeating
and rolling out spokespeople and endorsers from all over the fruited plant.
Marginalizing people who were against for or against the issue as some kind of hate mongers, or
certainly
the way it's always done, you know, the way people have been moved off an issue for years is you make them look like idiots, or you make them look like some kind of hate mongers, and nobody wants to be in that camp.
Well, that's true, and especially not elected officials. And that's the reason why I'm really grateful for the way Ohio's constitution sets it up versus some place like Massachusetts, where you have to pass through two separate sessions of the Massachusetts legislature. Now, that means that a lot of log rolling, a lot of backroom dealing, and a lot of arm twisting and threats of primaries and lack of support and withdrawing campaign funds from people who may want to be on one side of the issue, but because the opposition, whatever side that is, whether it's the pro or the con, seems to have a lot of deep pockets and deep connections, they can really force their will on the legislature, whereas they can't force it on the people.
It lets a lot of checkbook legislation take place.
And that's probably the worst kind of legislation you can get is checkbook legislation, one way or the other. But what happened in Ohio with State Issue 3 is that they collected the signatures, and it's on the ballot. And what it is, as we said, you can go to the Secretary of State of Ohio's website. It's www.sos.state.oh.us, and you're going to look at elections and ballot issues, and you're going to click through, and it's going to say, "What's on the ballot?" And you click on that, and you go down, and it says, "General Election, November 8th, Statewide Issues," and you click on that link, and it opens a page that shows you the three statewide issues, shows you the arguments for, the arguments against, the full language of the amendment as it will appear once it's adopted, if it's adopted, and all of the other basic information that you need to make an informed decision as a voter. Now, the point is that oftentimes the arguments for and the arguments against are written by those who really want to polarize. There's a lot of heat, but very little light. Now, on issue 3, honestly, I think there's quite a bit of light on it, as opposed to some of the other issues which we've talked about this week. On this one, I think there's a lot of light that's shed on this particular ballot issue by both sides.
I would agree with you on the pro side. I think the arguments are well written and well formed. I think on the negative side, they are flat out propaganda.
Well, and it is, but it's educational to understand when you're looking at it, because, you know, as you and I, Chuck, both, we tend to maybe be a little bit more, geeky about this than the average voter is. We're the type of guys who actually want to go down and find out how a judge turns in a questionnaire, because we like to be informed, and we like to pull it in from different sources. Now, one of the things that I found very interesting about this particular, the arguments for, They were written, and there are five gentlemen who prepared the arguments in favor of. Those five people are some of the leaders of the Liberty groups, of the Tea Party groups, who brought this issue to the ballot. Now, none of these guys that I know of are bureaucrats or functionaries. They all work full-time, regular Joe jobs like you and I do. This isn't their full-time life. This is something they do because they're passionate about the issue. They're passionate about liberty. They're passionate about freedom. They're passionate about restoring a balance to the relationship between the state and the federal government, to be quite honest about it. We're going to get into a little bit more about what that looks like as we go back into our Constitution and look at what it says about this issue of health care.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so the arguments for are written by, and I know all five of these guys, and they're all good people. They're all your average workaday Joes, just like you and I, and like the vast majority of people who are listening to this program. It's interesting that the arguments against Issue 3, the arguments against healthcare freedom, are coming from taxpayer-paid elected officials, and not just any elected officials. It's the leader, the minority leaders, and in this state right now, the minority is Democratic. It's the Democratic House Minority Leader, Armand Boudish, who used to be the Speaker of the House. It's the Democrat Minority Leader, Capri Cafaro, in the Senate, who never has been Senate President. And the way the lines are balanced, it's probably in her young lifetime, and she'll probably live longer than you and I will because she's younger than us. She never will become Senate President because it's been that way for 30-some years and doesn't look like the lines are changing anytime soon there. So basically, this is written by entrenched politicians.
Right.
Who are saying, no, we can't have an issue in Ohio that people say that we get freedom to determine our own healthcare choices.
Well, let's think critically for a second. They have a political iron in the fire, not necessarily an economic and family iron in the fire.
Oh, but wait a minute now, Chuck. When I looked at their arguments against, there are a lot of economic and family issues in there. I mean, they talk about working families, and they're talking about businesses, and they talk about, you know, people have an access to care.
Well, let's talk about that for a second. One of the things I noticed on the no vote, stop insurance companies from excluding people, including children with pre-existing medical conditions, from getting health insurance. Well, of course, that including children clause was in there to pluck the heartstrings.
Well, and
it does.
And before anybody starts calling you and I Simon Legree, you know what? It is. We do have a situation in this country where people do have conditions that, because of their conditions, that they have trouble getting health care coverage right now. But the main reason why is not because of the lack of health care out there.
That's right.
It's because of what government has already done. The federal government has already done since the 1970s in inserting government and bureaucracy into healthcare choices. You know, we've got a situation where we've now got third-party payors or third-party administrators by law, the insurance brokers or these health agencies, who, when you go to visit your doctor, it's no longer a arm's-length transaction between you and the physician, where you go in, tell him what's wrong with you, he researches, feels around, says, take two of these and call me in the morning, or let me set this bone, or here, let me remove that piece of wood out of the back of your head that you got hit with the 2x4 on. Yeah. That doesn't, and then he writes it, and then you go up to the front desk, he writes you a little bill and says, okay, let's see, gauze, 15 cents, two aspirin, 25 cents. Sutures.
You haven't been in the hospital recently, have you?
Well, I try to stay away from it as much as possible.
Yeah.
You know, it's a hyperbolic here. But the whole point is that he doesn't write you a bill for the actual costs of his time and the material that he had to use to get you
right.
Well, now they have to hire 2, 3, and 4 staff members, full-time staff members, depending on how busy the office
depending on the size of the practice.
Oh, no, it's not an exaggeration. I've talked to numerous healthcare providers, including some of my own, who have had to actually bring on 2 and 3 extra staff just to handle the paperwork with the various insurance companies. And they say, you know, and honestly, I have a number of providers that I look for who are willing to, if you want to avoid going through the insurance route and just pay directly, will offer you some significant discounts on their services because you're saving them money by not going through insurance. Now, what they end up doing is, in many of them, and especially hospitals are especially
right
culpable of this, and that is they'll end up billing, whether it's Medicare, Medicaid, or your insurer, they may end up billing 2 and 3 times what it actually costs because they know they're going to get knocked down based upon some schedule, and they're only going to get a percentage of what they bill, and that may or may not cover the actual hard physical costs of the equipment and the
right
material and the time.
This is a many tentacled monster because one of the reasons that hospitals do that is they have almost all to unity become profit making entities.
Right. There are very few as hospitals started. Because we talk about up here in Columbus, Riverside Methodist, Grant St. Anne's,
right.
who Catholic. That they originally hospitals were started by churches as a ministry, nonprofits as outreaches to the sick and the hurting, because of the charge they had as a church, as the body of Christ, to minister to those who are sick.
And the changes have come in the wake of Medicare and Medicaid.
Medicare, Medicaid, and federal government involvement.
Forced the churches out and basically forced allowed the for-profits to come in and buy up all the, or act as managers, quote-unquote, for
right.
a church-run.
And let's be quite honest, there's nothing wrong with for-profit companies.
No.
But the problem is that, especially in healthcare, it's not a true free market system because it's a regulated, government-directed healthcare system.
It's a crony capitalist system, too.
And if Obamacare here, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, actually continues on and becomes law. Well, it's a law that is not a law. It's facially a law right now, but there are numerous court challenges and one has ruled that it's unconstitutional, others have ruled that it's okay. The Supreme Court's going to end up having to probably consolidate all those cases ultimately.
Right.
And come up with a decision on whether or not this act by Congress that the Obama administration pushed actually is constitutional. Well, we can save the Supreme Court dozens of hours of debate and hearing testimony and thousands of reams of paper and killing trees to get all the motions and the counter motions and the claims and the charges filed, because we're going to walk you through here on the second half of today's program. We're going to walk you through the constitutional path as to why Obamacare, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, is unconstitutional and is no law. Now, everybody's acting like it's a law. Congress passed it. They're patting themselves on the back. The president signed it just like it's a law. They're trying to enforce it. They're pushing money to states to do things to get the exchanges started, the healthcare exchanges. They're assuming that we're going full bore. Kathleen Sebelius, the Department of Health director for the Obama administration, is pushing states to go ahead and do these things. You're already hearing, I'm hearing at least anecdotally from people where they're being told, especially if they're older, oh, well, you know that annual physical you get? Well, no, you can't get that anymore. It's going to be every 2 years, or you're going to have to wait a while to get this done,
right,
or we don't do that anymore.
Well, ask any of your friends or relatives who live in Canada.
Well, yes, and that's what we're starting to slowly see happening here in America.
I have relatives in Britain, and the first thing they will tell you, through my wife, whose family is from Britain, they will tell you right up front, hope you don't need to have like a leg amputated or something, because A, there's a high probability that they'll cut off the wrong leg, and B, there's a high probability that you won't be able to get your leg cut off until gangrene has already set in.
Yeah, because you become septic and you're going to die anyway.
And if you're in bad enough shape, the same thing will happen here as happens over there, and that is there's a determination made by someone other than a physician. There is a board that you submit to, and if you're in too bad a shape, you don't get the surgery.
Well, honestly, we kind of already have that now because you know what happens. You know, the average person goes in, you got something wrong with you. You're not sure what it is. It's not something external like, you know, you've got like scabs or something or some massive lesion on your skin, but you're not feeling well. Something's wrong inside. Well, you go to a doctor, and what happens? They issue out, instead of just kind of feeling around, having you cough, you know, checking your throat, you know, looking in your ear, looking in your eyes, and doing just that stuff, they may order a battery of tests, MRIs and CAT scans and EEGs and EEGs and blood work of 15 different varieties where they have to take blood out of both arms and one of your leg in order to make sure they get the right mix. And they do all this not because doctors are being trained differently now and they don't know how to care for the body. It's that malpractice claims have gone so high that they're covering themselves. They're saying, well, you know what, if something would happen and we missed something and then that person gets seriously ill or dies, then we're opening ourselves up to massive lawsuits. Now, I know doctors, especially obstetricians, who have left the practice because of malpractice insurance.
Yes.
Never, ever had a malpractice claim ever filed against them, but just their standard cost of annual insurance, I mean, for an OB, you have to keep insurance for 18 years after the date of the delivery of your last child. So basically, because of malpractice claims and because of the litigation that's involved, you now have doctors and hospitals that want to make sure they run every test under the sun in order to make sure they don't miss something. So even if you only have the common cold, they haven't misdiagnosed maybe a lymphoma. Now, what that does is that drives up the cost. Now, what happens is when they submit all those bills to you, well, first of all, your blood pressure goes up, and so now you need blood pressure medication. But secondly, what happens is you're immediately looking, well, you know, if you have insurance, you're immediately saying, well, my insurance company will handle that. Well, your insurance company, basically what they're doing, they're becoming a third-party administrator at that point.
Yes.
It gets kicked over to them. They review it, and they look at your health records, and they look at the what the doctors have described, and they may say, well, we'll allow that, but we'll only allow it at 20% of what they're billing it. We'll allow that, but we'll only allow it at 60% of it. Well, we're not going to allow that or that or that. We think those weren't necessary. They send the payment to the hospital or to the doctor, who then, let's say that the three or four things that they said were unnecessary were actually the things that actually were necessary, and the ones that they paid for weren't. What does the doctor do? Because if he gets back and what he's gotten back barely covers the costs of what it took to have these exam tests done. And let's not all kid ourselves, folks. We're talking about high-end technology here. It's not cheap to start.
No, it's not. And really what's happening here is the doctor has to run the price up on these tests. And the reason he has to run the price up is because the third-party payers will only pay maybe 40% or 50% or 60%. So they run the price up. Now, what does that do to a patient who is uninsured? In other words, paying for the tests out of pocket. Well, I've been in this situation where I was uninsured and I had tests run, and I started noticing that I was being billed for the full boat for the test. And I had to go to the doctor and say, you know, I'm not insured. I'm not paying this amount for this. I will pay you what the insurance company would have paid you.
Right. And honestly, ladies and gentlemen, for those of you who are out there who are listening who have been in that situation where you're not insured, you know you can do that. And you know that many, many doctors' offices and many hospitals want to work with you on it because, honestly, you know, what good does it do them to sue you and get your blood pressure up or make you have a stroke or a heart attack? They're going to have to take care of you anyway.
Besides that, you're a much easier patient to deal with because, despite the fact that they still have to keep employees around to deal with HIPAA, and that's one things I was saying about a many-tentacled beast, HIPAA is exceedingly expensive because of the record-keeping requirement.
Yes,
but nonetheless, you're not going through a middleman. They can bill you right away if you're not on insurance, and you will pay the bill usually within 30 days rather than sometimes sitting out. I'm getting bills for my wife's testing that she had done in July right now. This is almost November.
Yeah, you see, now we went through this situation just as a personal anecdote with our own daughter who ended up, she was playing and jumping up and down on the bed and, of course, flew off of it and hit her head on the floor. I had to have some stitches in her head. But we get a bill from the hospital, and it's for X number of dollars, which I thought was fairly exorbitant. Now, I didn't have insurance time. So my wife gets on the phone, calls the hospital and says, are you sure this is right? You know, and so we got down there, like, here, pay this amount, which was about 20% less. Still too high for what little bit of time. I mean, she was in there. She was in there 10 minutes and got 2 stitches. Okay, that's about the length of time. And this was like over $500 they were billing. So we came back around, and so my wife went ahead and sent the check. Well, we got a letter the day the check went out. We got a letter in saying, "Hey, we'll reduce it another 20% if you pay it within so many days." Well, they got the check. We called them up. They stopped, sent the check. We sent them the other payment. So we save 40% because that's what insurance would have paid.
And this is one of the troubles that you get into when people don't pay their own health bills. They don't really know what it costs.
It's just like when you've got a mortgage and your property taxes. If it's rolled into your mortgage and you're just paying a monthly payment to the bank, people will vote for property tax levies because they really don't understand
how
much they're
actually
paying. They
don't understand they're paying $400 a month,
right? Exactly,
on a $160,000 house,
right? Yeah. But that's an entirely different program that we're going to deal with later.
But it's part and parcel of the whole thing. The government has worked long and hard to separate things like that out so that people don't know what the costs are.
Right.
Now, one of the points I was trying to make with this stop insurance companies from excluding people, here's a scenario I'm going to give you. I've just had a car wreck. Can I call an automobile insurance company and say, you know, I've had a car wreck. Would you mind insuring me and paying the full cost for the wreck?
Yeah, no, I think there's somebody running a commercial like that right now where the guy's in a wreck and he calls the company and is like,
Jerry, you're
not with us anymore.
That's
and,
right.
Why are you calling? Yeah. Because you've already had the wreck because you're not covered.
Yeah, and therein lies the problem. People want to be covered for things. They want to go without. There are young people in this country that don't need health insurance. They go to the doctor for, unless they blow their knee out skiing or doing some sporting thing, they don't go to the doctor that often because they don't need to.
Yeah.
Now, it's us rapidly aging middle-agers.
Well, we won't share our ages with anybody. Just
I'm not afraid. I'm in my mid-50s.
Yes,
now,
you are.
Now, I don't go to the doctor very often either, and actually that ends up costing me money because of regulatory issues. My doctor charges me extra. My children had not been to the doctor for about 3 years. They claimed we didn't have any children, and I'm like, well, you treated them 3 years ago, and they're like, well, that's in a record that's off, you know, that's been electronicized, and it's off ties, and it's out in the cyberspace someplace, and we're going to have to actually pay someone to go get them to bring them back in.
Isn't that sad? They have to actually pay somebody.
Let me tell
you
something,
Barry.
I'm old enough that I can remember that we had a family physician who came to the house. And I remember that I had to have stitches in my feet, and he came to the house and gave me the stitches in my feet.
Yes,
now
indeed.
That hasn't happened. Now that's pretty close. That's 45 years ago or so. That hasn't happened in the United States probably since the mid 60s.
Maybe early 70s, because we still had doctors who did house calls when I was a young child in the late 60s, early 70s.
And the reason for that is, A, the number of physicians has been essentially cut back. The American Medical Association has restricted the number of medical schools to, and they admitted some of this, to create a monopolistic sort of system so that there were too few doctors so that they wouldn't have to make house calls and those kinds of things.
Well, but let's extend the logic on this, and this gets us right back to why issue 3 is important. If you've done that and you've restricted the number of doctors, now you can say we don't have enough doctors to cover everything, so now what do we have to do? We have to ration health care. We have to then control it, tell people what you can and can't have in your health care plans, tell them which doctors you can and can't see.
Yes.
Tell them how often you can go visit your doctor for certain items. Gee, that sounds like the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act.
Mm-hmm.
The legislation that was passed by President Barack Obama and the Congress back in 2010. Now, Chuck, I think we kind of came all the way around to hitting on what may be an underlying cause of this thing. What I want to do, though, with the time we have remaining, is to say, now, ladies and gentlemen, when you go to the polls and you look at state issue 3, Now, I don't expect you to remember all of everything we've talked about today, but what you're going to see when you look at the ballot language, and because I'll tell you what, honestly, nobody's going to take the time to read through the full text of the law of this issue when they're standing in the ballot box, because honestly, it'd take you a long time. But what you're going to read is a proposed constitutional amendment, issue 3, and it says to preserve the freedom of Ohioans to choose their health care and health care coverage. Proposed by initiative petition, that's a citizen's initiative, adopting section 21 of article 1 of the Constitution of the State of Ohio. And it says the proposed amendment would provide that, number one, in Ohio, no law, that means that whether it's the Federal Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, or a state-level law, or even a local municipal law that might be passed, an ordinance or statute, no law, and then this is the beauty. I love the attorneys that these guys use to draft this up, or rule, because that gets into administrative law, gets into bureaucratic agencies, because oftentimes a legislative body, whether it's your local city council or your state legislature, whomever it be, will pass laws. They'll pass generic laws. Then it'll get kicked over to agencies like departments of health or departments of job and family services in this state.
Or
a board.
Or a board or a commission.
Board.
Yeah.
And they'll write specific rules and guidelines on how to execute that law. Oftentimes the devil is really in those details, because those agencies, boards, and commissions
will use
that as a means of expanding their reach and control and power.
And as you and I know, because we're working on a different bill, which is not going to be the subject of this discussion, although it is related, we are working to rein in certain boards who have grossly overstepped the original intent of the law.
Oh, certainly. And this is the other part about this. So no law or rule shall compel, and this is beautiful, directly or indirectly. Now, what they mean by indirect compulsion is, let's say you're a healthcare provider. Let's say out there you're listening today, you're a registered nurse, or you're a physician, or you're a chiropractor, or you're any number of one of a licensed medical professional in the state of Ohio, who in order to practice in the state must go before a state board in order to qualify to get your license. Once you've gone through all your schooling and taken all your exams and your MCATs and everything else it might be, you have to go before the state medical board or the state board of nurses, all of the various healthcare professions have their own boards.
Board.
It's like Heinz 57 out there among the medical profession. But the point is, you could end up with this law, and it will happen, and we've already heard it happening, with this Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, where if you as a medical provider won't agree to carry out the law as it's written, in other words, and deny care for certain people, and only do certain things at certain times, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, well, that can be grounds for you either losing or not having your license renewed. That's indirect compulsion.
Right.
Because they'll never say it's directly related to that, but they'll just say, well, you know, you're not meeting the high ethical standards of the profession. And so, therefore, your license is revoked, voided, or we just won't issue it to you in the first place.
And the way they do it is the way they've done this since the 1970s or even before. They basically say if you don't comply, the federal government will come to the states and say, if you don't comply, we're cutting off the money for this.
Yeah, that's how it would be.
The way we got the 55-mile-an-hour speed limit for those horrible years from 1973 until the 1990s when people said this is absurd. Basically, they did it by going out, and some of the last places to do it were out west, where they have unlimited speed limits. Basically, the law is speed reasonable for conditions, which some people interpreted as 110 miles an hour.
Well, in Wyoming, you could possibly go there because it's long, flat stretches.
Montana, Wyoming.
Now, you can do that in the daytime, but I think at night they do have a limit because, you know, you have things like buffalo and elk and antelope that cross those highways at night, and you don't want to be hitting one of those at 110 miles an hour.
Well, they did the same thing with the drinking age limits. For instance, Ohio, you used to be able to, when I was 18 years old, we could go to a bar and buy what was called low-powered beer.
3-2, huh?
3-2 beer. And then all of a sudden it became a big deal. The Highway Transportation Safety Administration basically said, no, we want the age to be uniform 21. And if we don't get that, then you're not getting your highway
money. You don't get your highway money to fix your roads. Yeah, that's the way they do it. That's an indirect compulsion. So in Ohio, under the amendment, what you're going to read, in Ohio, no law or rule shall compel directly or indirectly any person, employer, or healthcare provider to participate in healthcare system. In other words, you don't have to be forced into a funnel. Number two, proposed amendment would provide that in Ohio, no law or rule, there it is again, shall prohibit the purchase or sale of health care or health insurance. Now, what that is, that's free market economics. That's saying we're not going to tell health care vendors, whether it's insurance companies or like AARP or whoever it is who provide insurance in groups or classes or whatever, that you can't operate in the state of Ohio because you're not only offering this that's under the PPACA. We say in Ohio, we have free markets. So if you want to come in and you want to provide health products, health insurance product, you can't be barred from doing that. And if you as a consumer want to buy a certain health insurance product, that, you know, if I want to buy a health policy to cover me bungee jumping off the side of the
new river bridge down there in West Virginia.
I'm just thinking just maybe off of the Fifth Third Tower there in downtown Columbus. You know what? If somebody's willing to provide that and sell it to me and I'm willing to pay the premium, why shouldn't I be allowed to buy it? Now, on the contrary, if I choose not to purchase into a traditional, what is called a traditional healthcare plan, but to do as I currently do, and I know, Chuck, you do as well.
Right.
But we are involved in a Christian cost-sharing affiliation. It's called Samaritan Ministries. Basically, it's where believers work together and share each other's burdens, as the Bible directs us to, in the area of healthcare. You become a member, and of course, you have to go through, and there's a questionnaire, and you have to fill it out, and you have to agree to certain things, and agree to statements of faith and belief, and you have to actually get it signed by your pastor or elder that you attend church regularly and you're not in gross venial sins or anything like that or doing anything destructive to your body to start with. But you get into the program, and then instead of writing a check every month and sending it off to some blind administration that you do with traditional insurance, you know, when you send it to Progressive or Prudential or any one of the health, any insurance company that provides health insurance, where you know that 95% of what you're writing out is going to overhead and administration and a great load of bureaucracy. I'm writing a check to a family or an individual who's also in the program, who's had a health need, and I'm helping to cover it. So instead of paying a premium, I'm giving a share to another individual who I also get the opportunity to pray for, to send a note to of encouragement and of scriptural support. I can get my kids involved with it. And my wife and kids do wonderful. They do these little notes, and the kids draw things in them. And, you know, we talk to the families because it may be something where somebody's had a birth. It could be that somebody's had a heart condition. Mm-hmm. Maybe somebody's struggling with cancer. Maybe they've had a traumatic car accident. Point is, it isn't just a blind and faceless insurance company that's negotiating with the hospital and saying how much they're going to pay, and we don't care what the needs of the patient. It's other believers coming together and sending voluntarily resources to help that person cover their costs. Now, folks, you know, I'm going to say that it's difficult for many people to get away from the traditional healthcare model, to get their heads around the idea that all of the stuff we think is necessary and important in relation to healthcare really isn't. And honestly, if we're good stewards of the temple of the Holy Spirit that God's given us, and we watch our intake of things, and we moderately exercise, and we try to reduce and limit stress, and we don't do things that are extremely destructive, You know, I think somebody who decides that they want to go, you know, walk over fire pits all the time for their enjoyment, maybe this isn't the program for you. But for those who are willing to actually be more biblically and thinking in their mindset about their own and their family's health care, this is a great alternative to traditional insurance, which oftentimes doesn't. Now, it's not catastrophic. Now, it's again, it's not a traditional insurance plan.
Right.
And honestly, this organization had to basically pay people in their organization to go to D.C. to lobby while this health care bill was going on to be exempted from the mandates under the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act, because they're not an insurance product. They work to administer, and people basically, you go, you get injured, you go to the hospital, you get your treatment, they send you the bills, you submit it with a form to the Samaritan Ministries. They then have have rules and standards, which you know up front before you sign up, what they will and will not cover. If it meets the criteria, then in the next newsletter it goes out and they divvy up. Because I know when you get your monthly newsletter, Chuck, the person's name on yours that you may be sending your share to could be totally different than the person I'm sending
it
to.
Yeah, we're new enough on the plan, we're still sending our money to the directly.
Well, you only
to,
do that for the first couple of months.
A few months.
Well, and then you go straight out.
Then
there.
You go straight to a person. You get a sheet that says make your check payable to such and such and so and so. And then I know every month too that there are requests that aren't on the plan, and they will solicit if you want to send in a little extra.
Sure.
If everybody sent in $20 extra, then we could meet all the people that aren't on the plan. So they actually,
and by that he's not necessarily talking about people who are outside the plan. It's people whose conditions that weren't qualifying conditions.
For instance,
pre-existing conditions.
Yeah. And those kind of pre-existing conditions are one of the main reasons that somebody might not be on the plan. You know, a pregnancy that was there before they switched insurance over to this form of insurance and that kind of thing.
Or a heart condition, right, or whatever it might be.
Now, one of the things I wanted to bring up was something, one of the things that you raised, and that is, you know, this thing about walking on hot coals or bungee jumping and those kinds of things. The fact is that health insurance, that this federal coverage is really designed to force you and me to pay for lifestyle illnesses in part.
True.
That come from people who want to engage in risky behaviors.
That's true.
And yet also want to have someone else pay their medical bills for that risky behavior.
Right.
And we can think of all kinds of practices and things that, you know, it's not just bungee jumping or firewalking. It's sexual practices and those kinds of things.
Well, there's that too, yes.
And these are risky behaviors, and there are consequences to the risks. Anyone who isn't well versed in what those risks are has to be comatose, because they haven't been paying attention for the last 30 years or so, or even longer than that, because
I'm not sure if the word comatose is the right word, or if it's
denial.
Well, let's be biblical about it, that their consciences may be seared.
That's true.
That those practices, those risky behaviors, they do them anyway, even knowing the risks. But then, because there are consequences involved with our behaviors, it's time for someone else to pay the bill for them. Now, you see, that's the big problem with victim mentality. But, you know, again, that's entirely another show we can deal with. We haven't come up with some great show ideas while we're recording this show, ladies and gentlemen, tell you. And we'll try to get to all of them over the time that we're on air here. But going back here right now to issue 3, the other big thing that this says is that if this amendment passes, that in the state of Ohio, no law or rule shall impose a penalty or a fine for the sale or purchase of health care or health insurance. So in other words, if I choose to go out and buy the Cadillac plan for my family, as long as I pay for it, everything's fine. If Chuck goes out and decides to choose the Edsel model for his family, you know what? the federal government or the state or the municipality can't come in and say, well, Mr. Michaelis, you are substandard care of your family here. We're going to charge you $10,000 in penalties per month until you buy enough insurance that we feel meets a minimum.
Thank you for bringing that up, because one of the arguments for the no vote that is absolutely false is that they're going to protect Ohioans from catastrophic health care expenses that result in bankruptcy. Well, sorry, folks, what they're going to do is bankrupt small companies, because there are fines involved for failure to buy health insurance plans. And this is supposedly going to help small businesses provide health insurance for their employees. No, it's not. What it's going to do is make sure that employees are not hired, because we're even seeing that now in this recessionary time. There are companies who have no idea what's going to happen when this thing kicks in full bore and are failing to hire new employees and making their current employees work harder,
mm-hmm.
because they don't know what's going to happen. They don't know what the costs are going to be, although they can guess. And like I've been guessing, and it's going to be catastrophic. It's going to cause massive inflation. It's not going to help me hire anybody. It's not going to help me buy in health insurance. What it's going to do is basically cost me gobboons of money and possibly cost me my business.
Well, and unlike some of the businesses, now, you know, we've got three tiers of businesses that are dealt with the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. You know, you have your very small business like you're talking about who can't afford to cover, so they probably won't hire employees.
Right.
Or they may have to discontinue health insurance coverage totally, because health insurance coverage is not a right in the state of Ohio or under our constitutional form of government.
Which, as we've talked, is part of the plan, I think, because what people at the federal level really want to do is to have a single party payer, and that being the federal
government, which honestly is probably the worst system that we could possibly hope to have, because that's the European model. That's what we're seeing in socialized medicine in foreign countries, where you're hearing the horror stories about people waiting months, if not years, to deal with illnesses and diseases that if it were treated early on would have extended the quality and duration of someone's life. But because they had to wait in their system for so long, they either were so far along in their disease or illness that there was no being able to bring them back from it, or they died in the process, or with those who could afford to do so, they left the country and came, guess where?
Yeah.
The United States for their health care.
Well, at one point, there was a statistic that said there were more MRI units in Buffalo hospitals, Buffalo, New York, than there were in the entire country of Canada. And the reason was nobody could afford to buy one. It was not something that the Canadian health agencies were mm-hmm. paying for, so... Basically, if you wanted an MRI, you went to Toronto to one of the hospitals, one of the very few regional hospitals that had one, or you went to Buffalo and signed up for it and basically got one the next day.
So there were a lot of Canadian driver's licenses being shown in Buffalo at the hospitals.
Well, yes.
But going back around, the three different types, so you got your small businesses who probably can't afford it at all and either will not hire people, and that's a two-edged sword, okay? You must have health care coverage. Okay, your employer you can't be hired to work and earn money because they can't afford to hire you because they have to pay for health care coverage. How are you going to pay for health care coverage?
Right.
Then you go to the medium-sized employers, medium to large, and many of them have already said, hey, we've run the numbers. It'll break our backs. We're just not going to offer it at all.
What this will do is shift employment from... The backbone of America, the American economy, is the small business owner. What this will do is shift the burden over to corporations. Small businesses will not be able to stay in business if they have to either buy coverage or pay a fine. But what will happen is corporations who can do the profit margins necessary, they'll just raise prices because they know they're still going to be cheaper than the small business.
But now you bring up the other thing, and that's the little quiet part of the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. Many large businesses, those mega corporations, got waivers. They're exempt from having to deal with the mandates in the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act.
And how did they get those waivers?
Because they're big money contributors to a certain political candidate or certain political parties. That money talks. Okay, ladies and gentlemen, money talks. Many of these big companies you're hearing about every day are getting these waivers from healthcare were the ones who, during the debates, were the ones out there supporting the bill. Gee, I could support a bill if I knew that I wasn't going to have to pay the cost
of it.
Especially if I thought everybody else was going to pay the cost of it and I got the benefits of it.
Well, there are certain state governments that have come out and gotten waivers.
Yes, they have as well. Now, Ohio's not one of them because it's my understanding that the current administration is actually working on plans on how to implement the exchanges, the healthcare exchanges within the state of Ohio. Part of the reason why we need to we'll go back to issue three here and look at it carefully. Now, I love issue three because it is truly a citizen's initiative, and it's truly based on a constitutional principle. That principle is called federalism. Where do we find federalism in the Constitution, ladies and gentlemen? Article 10 of the Bill of Rights. In other words, the 10th Amendment. Made the top 10, that's right. Which says, the powers not delegated to the United States by the Constitution. Now, I'm going to stop everybody there. We're going to do a real brief Institute on the Constitution training, Constitution quiz for you. Okay, where do we find the powers delegated to the United States in the Constitution? Well, we find them in the first seven articles of the Constitution itself. Articles 1 through 7 are all the powers of the three branches. Now, we're talking about a law here, dealing with health care, statutes. Who has the control over law? Well, Article 1, Section 1 of the Constitution says all legislative powers herein granted shall be vested in a Congress of the United States. Well, that's right. Congress passed health care, right? Yeah, they did. Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act was passed by Congress. Okay, where did Congress get the authority to do that? Well, people say, well, yeah, I know there's something in Article 1. Yeah, it's Article 1, Section 8, which gives Congress the powers that they have. Now, I can go down through here. We probably don't have enough time, but let's just say, folks, grab a pocket copy of the Constitution. Go to Article 1 of the Constitution. Go to Section 8. I want you to read down through of all the things. It says, Congress shall have power. And then it lists a bunch of things. Delay and collect taxes. Borrow money. Regulate commerce. Establish naturalization and bankruptcy laws. Coin money. Provide for counterfeiting punishment. Establish in post office. Copyrights and registered things. To define and punish piracies and felonies, to declare war. You know, the big thing is when you get down to the end of Article 1, Section 8, the one thing you don't find in here is Congress shall have the power to determine health care policies. It's not in there, ladies and gentlemen.
And it's not implied either.
And it's not implied either. So back to the 10th Amendment. The power is not delegated to the United States by the Constitution, nor prohibited by it, the Constitution, to the states as Article 1, Section 10. Article 1, Section 10 spells out the things that states cannot do. And honestly, it's mainly a list of all the things Congress has the authority to do that the states can't do. Health care is not in there. So it's not prohibited to the states to do anything with health care. But it says if it's not prohibited to the states, they're reserved to the states respectively or to the people. The four most important words in the 10th Amendment, the last four, or to the people. And it's the people in Ohio who've decided that the federal government has no right to be determining health care. And honestly, we the people don't want to leave it up to the state because we see what they're doing already. They're going to genuflect to the federal government because there's money involved. So we brought issue three to the ballot. Folks, if you go to the ballot on November the 8th, you're going to have a choice on whether to vote for having your control, truly local, the most local control you can possibly have, which is you as the individual and heads of your families, in determining your health care, or we're going to leave it to the federal government to centralize and ration health care for everybody.
And don't buy the rhetoric that this is going to save you money. It's not going to save you money. And even if it does, it's going to cost you control of your own resources and your own life.
That's right. So, ladies and gentlemen, to wrap up, issue one in relation to the mandatory minimum retirement age for judges is going to be on your ballot, and you can say yes or no to that. Issue 2, relating to making changes to Ohio's 28-year-old collective bargaining law, is on the ballot, and you can say yes or no to that. And Issue 3, regarding putting into the Constitution a provision to protect us from having health care mandates, is on the ballot, and you can say yes or no to that. Visit us at principledpolicy.com in the next week, and we'll tell you what we say to those three. We'll be putting those up on our website, and we'll have our endorsements up for your review before you go to the ballot. So for Chuck, for myself, for the entire board of the Institute for Principled Policy, say thank you for joining us, and we hope that you have a great weekend, and we'll hopefully be back here on Monday after for another edition of Principles and Policies.
See you Monday at 5:30.